Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, California's boardroom quotas. And Richard, since the last time that we talked, Jerry Brown, the outgoing governor of California, has signed a piece of legislation into law that is going to mandate publicly held corporations based in California to have at least one woman on their boards by the end of next year. Over time, that number actually rises for some businesses. The bigger your board, the more women you're required to have. There's a lot of different ways that we can take this, but let's just start with the straight ahead policy question here. The theory here is that women are underrepresented in corporate America, and that it is so out of whack that it is thus justifiable for the state government to get into the business of scrutinizing board composition. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, the question is everybody in the United States wrong, or is the California legislature wrong? And it's an awfully difficult question to decide how many women ought to be on any board. But the first and obvious point is that there are many different businesses in many different industries, and there would be no particular reason to believe that women should be as well represented in one industry as in another. So, you know, if you take certain kinds of technical areas, it's very heavily male-dominated, like engineering and so forth. And so if you look at the available pool in that area and the ratio is 80-20, if you had a board at roughly that number, that would be pretty accurate. If, on the other hand, you go to another industry which is female-dominated, say an industry like cosmetics, you would expect to see more women on the board. And then there are other kinds of business like journalism and publishing where nobody knows much from one way or another which way you ought to go. So the idea that you need a standard rule for all boards is I think, incorrect. Let's suppose you thought that women should be 50% of all boards. It doesn't mean that each board should have 50% women. And if you had some boards which had, say, 70% women and other boards that had only 30% women, that would get you to the same place, but by a very different means. When you start to impose this kind of requirement, there's a kind of an illusion that there's an infinite or a very large supply of qualified board members for every particular position. And the word qualified is really a very dangerous misnomer under these circumstances. There are lots of ways in which you could qualify to get into college or to do something of that sort. But to be on a board, just to be qualified, is a guaranteed is guaranteed mediocrity. What you really need on those cases is people who have genuine specified excellence. And so if you have boards that needs an operations person, you want to find an operations person. You want a board that needs an engineer, you want to find an engineer, and so forth. And it's not at all clear that they're going to be an infinite supply or a very large supply of women for these highly niche positions, any more than it's going to be clear that there's a large supply of men. So what happens is these kinds of mandates can lead to, I think, a reduction in efficiency in some kinds of boards. If you actually look at this politically, the pressure on public corporations by all sorts of people to increase the number of women on boards is really very enormous. And it's not as though when you're doing this piece of legislation that California is running into corporations which are adamant to say, under no circumstances will we do this. There are about 17% of companies that have no women on their particular boards. But again, it's not at all clear that each of these should have the number that is required, maybe half that number, maybe none at all. And so what it is it's a kind of a very confident assertion from the center that they know how to control this. And what they don't understand is how companies are going to react to this. Some will comply. Some may well leave the state.
So walk me through the legal side of this, Richard, because Jerry Brown, in signing this, actually acknowledged the legal concerns around the bill, and he even referred to them, I think this was in the message that accompanied it, as potentially, this is his phrase, fatal to its ultimate implementation. Where could a law like this be vulnerable in the courts?
Well, there are many, many places. The first one is there's some federal issues. There's an old expression from a law case long, long ago saying, do the courts of Tobago bind the world? And Tobago is that little island near Trinidad. And so it is here. Why is it that California is trying to decree to companies which have operations all over the place, many of whom are incorporated in other states, that if you do business and have a principal place of business in California, you're going to be bound by this? Other states will strongly disagree with this particular policy, particularly particularly Delaware, which generally is fairly free market oriented in the way in which it deals with its particular boards. So there's going to be the question as to whether or not you could get that kind of reach. Second kind of question is, when you start to mess around with a corporate charter in the form that they're doing so here, does that amount to an abrogation of the corporate charter? There's an old case called Dartmouth College in which the state of New Hampshire wanted to take over Dartmouth College, and all it did was to mandate changes in the composition of its board. And John Marshall said the contracts clause says you can't go back on these particular charters. And so if people were incorporated under other rules, and to now come back and say, you know, you did get your corporate charter under these rules, and now you have to have a certain percentage of female board members, there's going to be at least an argument that this is such a fundamental change in the governance structure that it would be an illicit violation of the contracts clause, which governs state applications. This is very much on chartered territory, but it cannot be this way dismissed. There's also going to be, I suspect, some kind of an equal protection clause. There is, under these circumstances, no requirement that any corporation have a minimum number of men on a particular board. And somebody can say, when you have explicit sex consideration, you have to explain why it is you're not prepared to go both ways. I think one of the things that California could do is to mandate male minimums and try to deal with this particular situation. But nobody's sure whether or not it's going to want to do that. And then, you know, there are probably going to be some challenges of the sort that I've never even dreamed of that will be raised against this particular statute. And so unless you know all of the fine print, which I do not, you can't be sure of all the particular challenges that are likely to be raised. But there's no question that there's going to be somebody who's going to challenge this and probably make a pretty strong case that they've tried furiously hard in order to come to meet this particular mandate. But in fact, to do so would require them to compromise the way in which they run their business. So if that situation starts to come up, it could present a fairly appealing situation. And then, of course, there's just a simple novelty. No other state has done this. Why is it that you're going to have one state do this? And if you're trying to figure out what the reasons are, the one that Jerry Brown gave is a dead loser. I mean, he says, well, there are more than 50% of the people in the country are female, therefore more than 50% of board members should be there. He doesn't even try to ask the question as to whether or not the pool of potentially qualified applicants is proportionate to the general population. And for many corporations that require technical degrees of one sort or another, that's going to be manifestly false. In fact, I think it's kind of sad that he would put such an elementary and wrong explanation for this particular situation. You can be strongly desirous of having more women on boards and then look at the enormous shift in the composition that's taken place in the last couple of years, so that now on most public corporations, at least in 2018, about a third of the board members appointed have been female. So this is a problem, if it's a problem, that's going to cure itself. And why do you want to take the chance of alienating large numbers of businesses? And the point one would want to stress, it's not only that some companies are going to leave California, it's going to be highly likely that new companies are going to stay away from California if they hope to go public and have some control over their board membership.
To that last point you made about this problem sort of in a, at least to some degree, solving itself up to this point, when we look at an example like this in California, state passes a law. You're looking at the starkest public policy version of this attempt to force diversity where it doesn't already exist. But this isn't just limited to the politicians. There are certain types of institutional investors that have been pushing for moves like this too. And if you read the Wall Street Journal's reporting on this story, you will see in there a quote from a woman who is on several corporate boards saying that because of that, because of the institutional investor pressure, the market forces are working. That's her phrase. Is that the right way to think about this? Diversity push is bad as a public policy lever, but good when it comes from investor pressure?
Well, there's no way I think that you could legitimately stop investor pressure. There's a real complicated question as to whether or not when the investors are doing this, they're interested in gender equity as an end in itself, or whether or not they think it's going to actually improve productivity. There are people who think it's very easy to have it both ways. So today, for example, there's a whole pullout section in the New York Times talking about some of these issues. And the claim is made, which I regard as over the top, which says that if you had perfect gender equity on all boards, you would increase the gross national product of the United States by 26%. I can't think of any single initiative anywhere ever that could move you more than a couple of tenths of points. So this one just seems to be in cloud cuckoo land. I just don't believe it at all. But yes, I mean, if boards want to do this and they want to sacrifice financial profitability to other ends, there's nothing that I can say which says, no, you really ought to think of it in the other way. They may have to pay some kind of a market response because the guys who are actually buying and trading stocks care less about gender equity and more than value. If it turns out that women add value to corporations, this is a no-brainer. Of course, you ought to do it. But there's another problem here, which is always difficult, which is at the margin. Right now, we do have some kind of an equilibrium. Companies are looking very aggressively to find women. And now if you're going to start to say, we've got to get ourselves another 100 or another 1,000 or another 5,000 women into this mix, what's going to happen? Well, the prediction would be that the average quality would go down as you're going deeper into the pool. The prediction would also be that in order to attract women, you're going to probably have to pay them more than men in order to fill those particular slots. And that itself gives rise to another set of odd questions. Is it appropriate to pay women a 30% premium over men, particularly if you think that they may well be less qualified than the men with whom they're in competition? This will play out in many, many strange ways. And I think, in effect, that generally speaking, patience is the appropriate situation. There is no evidence in Europe that putting more women on boards changes the way corporations run. And the real concern about most women in many cases is the number of CEOs that you have. And that number has actually fallen in the last couple of years so that they're now, instead of having about 5% of the CEOs of the Fortune 500 being female, it's probably 4% or something like that. I don't see how you can mandate to a corporation that it must appoint its next CEO as a female if, in fact, all the people on the particular organization, the women included, think that a male is better qualified. But you never quite know how far this is going to go. And in fact, if you look at somebody like Elizabeth Warren, she comes up with what I regard as a very dangerous scheme to say, if you don't appoint the right people to the board representing, say, labor movements like gender movements, then the federal government is going to get an agency and appoint it to you. That one I regard as completely unconstitutional, much too coercive. It's government nationalization. This program putting a requirement but leaving the selection to the board is obviously much less intrusive.
So the last question that I'll put to you, Richard, what value, kind of zooming out here, what value should we assign diversity in a vacuum? By which I mean, for proponents of bills like this one, diversity is almost always conceived of as an undiluted good, regardless of how or in what context it's been applied. Has it come to the point where we're placing too much of a premium on it as a society? And if so, what would be a better way to think about it?
Well, I think it's gone way over the top. And the problem that you always have is that if you do any monetary market, people will start to sort in accordance with their interests and their talents and their abilities. And so if women think they're stronger at one set of skills, say interpersonal relations, than men, they will tend to move to professions that start to deal with that. And if men are stronger in other kinds of things like mathematics and spatial organizations, they'll move in that particular direction. If the diversity program is designed to say, particularly in professions where women are in the shortage, that women should be 50% of men, the real danger in this situation is you will force out relatively strong men and put weaker women into their place. This is a very unfashionable thing to say. But in effect, if these corporations are already, they're not opposed to hiring women. This is not like saying women must stay at home and take care of children. But if they make individuated judgments, those judgments are likely to be a lot more reliable than those which are made by the government. And there's also the other side of the particular problem, which is female autonomous choices are often different from men. So let me give you the law firm version of this, which I think is kind of instructive as to the power of gender selection by the people, the employees, not by the employer. If you look at the graduates of law school, they're basically now probably 50% or even a little bit more female than male. And if you start looking at entry-level jobs, already there's some degree of separation in which men tend to be in slightly larger proportions at the very large, aggressive corporate firms that are going to do securities, litigation, and major mega deals of one kind or another. So let's assume that they are now at 55-45 male to female. When you get to the partnership level at virtually all of these firms, all of a sudden it starts to look 80-20, 85-15 male. And this is pretty much across the board. And why has this happened? It's not because the firms fire women under many circumstances. It's quite the opposite. They will give them enormous inducements to stay, going far beyond anything that might be required by the sex discrimination rules. What happens is they say, look, I don't want to have that kind of lifestyle. I'm married. I have a bunch of children. I want to work 9 to 5. And so if you look at other kinds of places, like, for example, universities where they have very sophisticated people in their general counsel's office, those offices tend to be 70-75% female. And, you know, that kind of separation, it seems to me, is a pretty healthy thing, so long as it's done on the basis of choice by both sides that are informed. I think the notion that there's some stereotypical version which says, you know, women can't do X is so far removed from the modern situation that it should be dismissed as a very remote possibility. And in fact, you know, if you start looking at the champions of diversity, many of them are men as well as being women. My view about it is I think that what happens is you must understand that if you're trying to figure out how you get a match, it takes two to play. And in all of these cases, the selection by employees as to the kinds of firms and the kind of work that they want to do is very, very important. And you can't really overcome that. So take another illustration. I think Mona Charon has an interesting new book on gender equity going into schools. And sure enough, you want to go into naval architecture, and you look at the applicant pool, it's 97% male. You look at social work, and it's 85% or 88% female. This is not because of discrimination on the job. This is because of the preferences of the people who are there. And diversity and inclusion, in many cases, doesn't respect individual differences that individual men and women feel in their occupational choices. So I don't see this as liberating. I think, in effect, what it does is it creates a very unfortunate institutional dynamic. Whenever I advise students, men or women, the first thing I ask them is what they want to do, and then I try to help them achieve their ends. I don't sit there and tell them, you know what, there's an insufficient number of women working in large, kind of complicated firm, and you better go there. That's not the kind of advice I give. And indeed, virtually everybody who gives individuated advice tries to tell the person whom they're talking to, this seems to be the best for you. And then when you sum up all of those private decisions, it doesn't fit the grand pattern of diversity. So to put it in another way, there are many people, male and female, said in an ideal world, we'd have much more gender balance across areas. And so they're in favor in the abstract. But if you're going to ask themselves, are you willing to make a switch in your particular job so as to advance that particular goal, the personal sacrifice is too large, so people start to back off. I think that we are pretty much in equilibrium in a profession like law firms. That is, women have been in large numbers in the legal business now for over 40 years. And if you start to see these kinds of breaks persisting for that period of time, the thought that you could somehow or other develop a set of incentives that's going to take in large firms 80-20 and turn it into 50-50 is, I think, a very strong pipe dream. I don't think it's desirable to try to force it, and I don't think it would succeed. So my view about diversity is let the market forces work. They will certainly make some sort of a change, but it's going to be slower and more sensible than the ones that are proposed. And oddly enough, you'll get more economic growth if it's done voluntarily than if it's done through California coercion.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.